Tisha B'Av conjures up the most desperate and sorrowful images. It is, after all, the day of Churban. Churban seems to have a certain finality to it, and yet there is the promise of an ultimate geula, and there is in the kinos the sense that there is going to be a return to Tzion, and there is going to be a new world. The whole world will be renewed with the Bayis Shlishi. I wanted to focus on this, this particular Tisha B'Av. I wanted to stress that Geula, that is the ultimate Geula. This idea of focusing on the Geula is not a Tisha B'Av concept. It is, in fact, something that we are obligated to do day in and day out. I would like to suggest, based on the wording of a bracha that we make every time we say the Shmona Esrei of Chol, the weekday Shmona Esrei, three times a day, Shachris, Mincha, Arvis, we have a bracha that focuses and zeroes in on the Geula. And in that bracha, there is a phrase that I dare say we do not pay enough attention to. And when we do, and we translate it as it ought to be translated, we are seized, we shudder. Are we fulfilling, are we telling the truth? And that phrase is, ki lishu asecha kivinu kol hayom. What does ki lishu asecha kivinu kol hayom mean? Es tzemach dovid abducha mehera satzmiach v'karno tarum bishu asecha. We ask the Ribbono Shel Olam to bring back the Malchus of David. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to provide for us the ultimate salvation. And then we say that it is particularly for this salvation, for that ultimate Geula, that we are Kivinu Kol Hayom. I ask you, what does Kol Hayom mean? That little hay that begins the word Hayom makes all the difference in the world. If the bracha of Es Tzemach David would have said, ki lishu ascha kivinu kol yom, then it would have meant that we have to think about the Yeshua every single day. A day should not pass. And in fact, since we mention it in the Shmona Esrei, not once, not twice, but three times, and even in Shabbos, there's the Mincha before Shabbos, and there's the Ma'ariv Motzai Shabbos. So we are, in fact, mentioning it every single day. Unfortunately, or to be more precise, fortunately, we do not say Kol Yom, we say Kol Hayom. What does Kol Hayom mean? It means all day long. Isn't that a lie? Aren't we fibbing the Ribbono Shel Olam? We're talking to Hashem. We're asking Him for Yemos HaMashiach. We're asking Him for the ultimate Geula. And then we say that this is what we are thinking about every moment of the day. We are hoping for the Yeshua all day long. What about our business activities? What about our learning Torah activities? We are immersed in Torah. We're busy with Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, the Rambam, the Ravid. We are busy with all kinds of things. We are busy with our families. We are busy with Zmiras on Shabbos. Where is the Kili Shuascha Kivinu Kol Hayom? All day long. It's a tremendous question. What is the answer? I think that the answer is found in a moshel of the Nesivos Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe. I think the answer is found in a moshel that I might give, which is perhaps even more appropriate and more obvious. let us begin with the parable of the Nesiv HaShalom. It seems that a number of Slonim or Hasidim in Yerushalayim that were very immersed in Torah learning, and they had all their creature comforts provided for them. They were very happily married and settled. They had a wonderful dira in which to live in Yerushalayim. They lacked for nothing. And they spent the whole day immersed in Torah and Avodah. And their life was almost perfect. So one day, around the breakfast table, they asked one another to perhaps clarify what is it that they're missing now that they will benefit from Yemos HaMashiach, from the days when Mashiach, the Messiah, will come. What's the difference? They have whatever it is that they truly need in the service of Hashem, in the learning of Torah, in their creature comforts, right now. One of them answered, "You're selfish. You think only in terms of yourself. Maybe for you there won't be any difference. But what about all those people that are not immersed in learning? And all those people that do not have all these comforts? Aren't you thinking about them?" And so the discussion went back and forth for the greater part of an hour. And then they returned to their learning. One of these Kolel Chevra happened to meet the Rebbe, the Nesiv HaShalom, and he asked him this very question. "You know, we were discussing this at the breakfast table the other day. What does the Rebbe have to say?" So instead of answering him outright, the Rebbe gave him a mushel. He said there was a farmer, a hick, a very simple fellow, but he was also a philosopher of sorts. Not the educated kind, not the Harvard variety, kind of self-made. And he was always thinking big and hypothetical thoughts. While he was pushing his plow, he was thinking these thoughts. And he came to a question which for a while he could not resolve. He says, "I know why I need feet, because I have to push the plow and walk along with it. For the very same reason I know, that's why I need my hands, to push the plow. Why do I need my head?" And this was bothering him tremendously. Why does he need his head? And finally, after hours of contemplation, he came up with the answer. He says, "You know, it gets very hot, and so I have to wear a hat to protect myself from the sun. If I didn't have a head, what could I hang the hat on?" That was what the Nesiv HaShalom told them. That was his moshel. You know what he was saying? That your question reflects a perspective that is as absurd and as foolish as this farmer's answer of why he needs a head. Your problem, he's telling them, is that you are so immersed in the golos that is our lot, that it's inconceivable to you the greatness of the times of Mashiach and the tremendous transformation that is going to take place. And because of that, you need to think in current perspectives and in current terms. And therefore, you bandy about this reason or that reason, but every one of your reasons is exactly equivalent to the need for a head because he has to hang his hat. And as comical as that is, perhaps even more tragicomical, are your explanations. Because you are blind to the potential of Yemos HaMashiach. My mashal is simpler. You have a person who's colorblind. He sees everything that you and I see, but all is in black and white and gray. Try to explain to him the nuances of color. Try to explain to him the passion of red or the cool quality of green. Try to explain to him what the azure sky means to you or the incredible beauty of a sunset with its panoply of colors. He has no clue whatsoever. You take him outside. You bring him to a sunset. He sees light and dark. He sees white and black. You show him blue and green and red and violet. And to him, there's nothing there. And he cannot understand what you are so excited about. He cannot understand the subtlety of the painting in the museum. He cannot appreciate the color of the baby's eyes. In his blindness, a part of the incredible generosity of Hashem's world and its unbelievable beauty is completely lost to him. And no matter how much you'll tell him about what he's missing, since he's missing it, he doesn't have a clue. Rabosai, Yemos HaMashiach is exactly that to the person who is in Golus. And it is precisely that awareness, it is precisely that consciousness that makes us pine and yearn. Imagine if we would tell this colorblind person that there is another vision of the world. Imagine that we would tell him that there's a different perspective which has so much more to offer in the same reality in which he finds himself. There is a deeper reality and a higher reality and a more wondrous reality. And he realizes there must be something there, else why are you so excited? And what is making you try so hard to convey in words something that I cannot see? And so I yearn for it, and then wherever I go, whatever I look at, I imagine, what would it be like in that thing that he calls color? And I look at the sunset, or I look at the sky in the middle of the day, or I look at a sunrise, or I look at the moon and the pitch blue of the early evening. I look at the painting, I look at the child's face, and I cannot see what he sees. And it hurts me and it pains me. And wherever I am, I yearn, oi, halavai, if only I would have that pair of eyes. That is ki lishuascha kivinu kol hayom. It doesn't mean that I think all day long only about Mashiach. It means that my sense of the world as it is so much of a world that's fractured, a world that's broken, a world that is bereft, a world that is miserable, a world that is poor, a world that is in conflagration, a world that is desperate. And the image of a world that is tranquil, that is perfect. Imagine a world as the Rambam describes him. As the Rambam describes what happens in Yemos HaMashiach. The Rambam says that in the time of Mashiach, there's going to be such a tranquility. He says that in that time, there's going to be money, riches, gold, silver, whatever you value, diamonds, like the dust of the earth. There will no longer be competition. Everybody will have. There will be no hunger. There'll be no despair. There'll be no conflict. The whole world is at peace. But I would like to quote to you from the second Perek of Yeshayahu, of the Navi Isaiah. Let us see the vision of Yeshayahu. And let us ask, what do we have today? And what is this vision in Yeshayahu? And then I think that it will be crystal clear to all of us what kilishu oscha kivinu kol hayom, all day long, means. Because the distance between the Yeshayahu's nevuah and what happens today, the difference between the impact of the Jew, who's always busy thinking tikkun olam, but we cannot be misakin the olam. We can barely manage to survive. And imagine what it's going to be like in the days to come. Hadova asher choza Yishayahu ben Amoz al Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. V'hoya ba'achris hayomim, in the end of days. Nachon yiyeh har beis Hashem b'rosh harim v'nisa migvaos. The mountain upon which the house of God stands, the Har of Beis Hashem, will be on the top of the mountains, and it will be greater than every ridge. V'noharu elov kol hagoyim, and all the nations of the world will stream like a nohar, v'noharu elov. They will stream towards that house. V'holchu amim rabim, and it will be many nations who will make their way in that direction. V'omru, and they shall say, wherever they are, in every part of the world, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, from New Zealand, and from Africa, and from Canada, and from Russia, they will all say, V'omru, l'chu v'nale el har Hashem, el beis Elokei Yaakov. Let us go up to the mountain of God, to the house of the God of Jacob. I would like to pause for a moment before I continue. Why specifically to the house of the God of Jacob? In here, I believe, is the ultimate acknowledgement which we are yearning for so many thousands of years. To whom does this place belong? And we have the Christians with their crusades. We have the Arabs until today with their Al-Quds. It belongs to us. Mohammed rises up upon his horse from that place. And upon that place we have built a mosque. And that is our place. And it is our holy site. You are a usurper. Now, if it would have said that they claim that they want to rise up and go to that mountain of God, which is the house of the God of Abraham, Elokei Avraham, one could surmise that they never gave up their claim, because they too, Esav and Yishmael, are the descendants of Avraham Avinu. You know very well that their Akedah is an Akedas Yishmael, not an Akedas Yitzchak. If it would have been Beis Elokei Yitzchak, perhaps Yishmael might not have been able to make a claim. But Esav could still claim, I am the descendant, the Bechor, Vayetze Harishon Admoni, and it is my place. But if they are saying Beis Elokei Yaakov, in that phrase lies the ultimate admission. And they say it with enthusiasm. And they say it with encouragement. This is the place of the Jew. And it is because it is the place of the Jew that I want to go there. Why do I want to go there? Let us continue the pasuk. The pasuk says, El Beis Elokei Yaakov v'yoreinu midirachov. He shall inform us, he shall teach us, he shall inspire us with his ways. And we shall walk in his paths. Ki mitzion teitzei sora udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Isn't it amazing how familiarity makes us so comfortable with certain verses of Tanakh when we don't know sometimes even the other half of the verse or the verse adjacent to it, before and after? Everyone knows Ki Mitzion Teitzei Sora. But let us ask a question here. The Torah was given at Sinai. The Torah emanates from Sinai. And in fact, the reason that the Torah emanates from Sinai is because the Torah is not bound to Israel. And the commandment to learn Torah and to grow in Torah and to write Chidushei Torah and to develop and expound the Torah is universal and forever and cannot be limited exclusively to the Torah's Eretz Yisrael. What exactly do we mean? Ki mitzion teitzei sora, udvar Hashem mirushalayim. One of the answers is narrow. The other answer is much more wide-ranging. I will suggest both. One answer is, Ve'ele ha-mishpotim asher tosim lifneihem, the Pasuk says, in Sefer Shmos, the beginning of Parshas Mishpotim. And right before that, the end of Parshas Yisro, speaks about the Mizbeach. And Chazal tell us, Shetosim Sanhedrin, Eitzel ha-Mizbeach. The great Sanhedrin, the ultimate arbiter of halacha, the ultimate determiner of Torah, and the purveyor of Torah, the great Sanhedrin, belongs adjacent to the Holy Temple in the Lishkas Hagosis. And therefore, when that Sanhedrin will be renewed, and the temple, of course, will have been rebuilt, once again, the ultimate source and authority of Torah will be that Sanhedrin which is in Sion and Yerushalayim. And therefore, ki mitzion teitzei sora, udvar Hashem mirushalayim. But I would like to suggest something that is much larger and much incredibly more wide-ranging. And it goes to a fundamental truth about Yiddishkeit. We know Yiddishkeit in the black and white version, in the colorblind version. It's not just because we cannot fulfill many of the mitzvahs of the Torah, because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. We are not all in Eretz Yisrael, and we don't have the Avod of the Karbonos. It's just enough to think, you know, there are 2 days that we say, Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim. Only 2 days where we emphasize in our prayers, Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim. And what are those 2 days? The night of Pesach at the end of the Seder, Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim. And on Yom Kippur, at the end of Yom Kippur, Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim. You know why? Because there are 2 days where the entire day is, you'll forgive the expression, disemboweled of its essence. What is Pesach without the Korban Pesach? What is Pesach without the Korban Pesach? What is a Pesach without everyone streaming to Yerushalayim? What is Pesach without the Hallel that the rabbis tell us when they sang that Hallel? It's as if the roofs of each house in Yerushalayim exploded. Paka Igra. L'shona haba b'Yerushalayim. It's so not real. It's so bereft. It's so empty. It's disemboweled. What is Avodas Yom HaKippurim without a Kohen Gadol and without the Avoda of the Kohen Gadol and the Beis HaMikdash, without the Soyer HaMishtaleach? What is the whole of Yom Kippur without of the whole beginning of Parshas Acharemos? L'shono habo b'Yerushalayim. So we have so many mitzvos that we cannot do today. And that changes everything and makes everything black and white. The relation to Hashem, when Hashem is in a mode of hester ponim, of hiding his face, what would it be like if Hashem would reveal his face? No one knows, because we are so immersed, we are so mired in the hester ponim of the hidden face. How would you know? Everything is black and white. There's no color. What would it be like if all the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael? And so on and so forth. But I think that after having said all of that, we are missing the point. We are missing the point which explains ki mitzion teitzei sora udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Let me begin to make that point by referring to the first verse in Parshas Bechukosai. In Bechukosai teilechu Ves mitzvosai tishmeru va'asisem osam. Hashem promises the most incredible rewards and the most wonderful life for the individual and for Klal Yisrael, if only you walk in my paths and follow my precepts. Rashi, citing Chazal, asks that rabbinic question. If the mitzvos and keeping the mitzvos is already mentioned in that verse, what precisely is the first part of the verse, if you will walk in my precepts? What is that adding? And the answer that Rashi gives is that here lies a command that you should be immersed in the study of Torah. I have two simple questions. When you have a question why something appears on the surface to be redundant, and there's nothing redundant in the Holy Torah, the question is a question. It does not necessarily mean that we understand why that particular answer is an answer. Where did they see in the words, you should walk in my precepts, b'chukosai teilechu, that one should be struggling and toiling and persevering in the study of Torah? The second question is more technical. Who is obligated in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah? The men. Women do not have an obligation to learn Torah. To whom is im b'chukosai teilechu, that first verse in the last portion of Vayikra, of the book of Vayikra? To whom is that being addressed? The answer is to every man, woman, and child. Every Jew. Every single Jew. It's as generic and as overarching and as complete as you could get. And if that's the case, how could any of those phrases, regardless of the question of the redundancy, of the extra words, how could any of those extra words be referring to a commandment which is unique to the men of Israel? So how could you say that im b'chukosai teilechu refers to shetiyu amelim b'torah? Now the answer is that it's not referring to the mitzvah of learning Torah. And the whole thrust of this im b'chukosai teilechu is misunderstood unless you emphasize one word, and that is teilechu, you shall walk. Keeping mitzvahs, you don't use the word to walk. When you go on a path, when there's a derech, a lifestyle, a life's orientation, that is when you use the word derech, and that is when you speak about loleches, to go on the path. In b'chukosai teilechu means there's a lifestyle. I would change that. I would say there is a civilization of Judaism. There isn't a thing in life, in the way, in the hustle and bustle of the city or the comfort of the rural environment and the peace and tranquility of the farm. There isn't anything amongst the men, the women, or the children that isn't inspired by the vision of a Torah way of life. A Jewish civilization demands that every business activity is measured almost exclusively by our capacity for Kiddush Hashem and for integrity and honesty. That all of our endeavors are valuable and lead to the greater glory of Hashem and lead to the fulfillment of our responsibilities to Him. That everything that we touch somehow resonates with the messages of Torah. A Jewish civilization is something that we can only dream about. But one of the essential, critical components is that Torah learning and the knowledge of Hashem that comes from it and all that it inspires is the central vision, the central focus of man, woman, and child, each with their responsibility to achieve an in-depth, total absorption with Torah. That is, shetiyu amelim, toiling to understand Torah to the ultimate of the human capacity. When that becomes the vision of the entire society and allows the life aspects, the pragmatics of life, the currency of life's activities to be measured and valued by those Amelim Batorah principles, then you have a Jewish civilization. There is, in the Ramban over and over again, a vision that this kind of civilization can never take place anywhere unless the Jews are in Israel. And this kind of civilization embraces every possible aspect of our existence. When that happens, the Jew is capable, for the very first time, of genuine tikkun olam. That is, by the way, why the phrase tikkun olam, which comes from the words letaken olam b'malchus shakai, and is found in our tfilos and Rosh Hashanah and in our Aleinu, not in the first paragraph, but in the second. You know why? Because the first paragraph speaks about us in all times, when we are different from the rest of the world, and we accept Hashem. But we don't satisfy ourselves with that. We want a civilization that inspires the world to know Hashem, to accept Hashem, to seek guidance. How does everyone serve Hashem, Jew and non-Jew alike? And that yearning will lead to a society and a civilization which will in fact make that happen. Litakein olam b'malchus shakai, the kingdom of Hashem. But right now it's only a yearning. Al kein nekave liros mehera b'teferes uzecha. We dream, we hope, we yearn to see it soon. But we cannot see it now. There is no Jewish civilization that is immersed in Torah and is capable of having that dynamic. Not here, not in the land of Israel. Today, it doesn't exist anywhere. It's a dream. But when that dream comes true, it can only be in Israel. And when that dream comes true in Israel, the world will change. And all of a sudden, everything will no longer be black and white. And that vision is im b'chukosai teilechu, a civilization of Torah, a civilization of Yiddishkeit, which inspires everyone. And that Jewish civilization, the real life, the genuine living of Torah in every possible way, economic, scientific, in every possible way, even the entertainment will reflect a Torah perspective, and everything will be different. That is when Ki Mitzion Teitzei Sorah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim, when all the nations will stream to Zion because they want to see what is a civilization that the Jews have created in Yemos HaMashiach, and how can we benefit from it, and how can we learn from it, and how can we be inspired by it. And the Rambam says that at that time will be a time of Molah Haaretz. All people will want is to know Hashem, and that will be Molah Haaretz Deya Es Hashem Kamayim Layom Mechasim. Just like the waters cover every terrain so that it looks like a smooth coat of water, when we know that underneath there are all kinds of ridges and valleys. There's so much going on underneath the sea, but on the surface it looks so because it's covered. In the same way, that vision will cover every possible aspect. And there will be a consistency and a uniformity instead of the fractured worlds and multi-civilizations and the confusion and the anger and the resistance to Torah values that exist today. The Torah was given in a desert. The Torah was given for all times and all places. But that's to fulfill. That's to study. But the Torah civilization which inspires the rest of the world is yet to be. And that will come out of Zion. That will be from Yerushalayim. And you know what it says here? V'shafat bein hagoyim, v'yichiach la'amim rabim, and then the famous phrase which is etched on the wall of the United Nations. V'kitisu charvosam le'itim, v'chanisoseyem le'mazmeros, they shall beat their swords into plowshares. Lo yisa goyel goy cherev, V'lo yilmedu od milchama. Nation shall not lift sword against nation, nor shall they any longer learn the arts of war. That is what kilishu oscha kivinu kol hayom means. That is what kilishu oscha kivinu kol hayom means. To understand that what we have now, under the best of circumstances, and with the most perfect ideal of learning Torah, of keeping mitzvahs, is black and white. And when you know that the world around you is black and white, and you've been told about color, your yearning for color is a constant that invades and seeps into every single moment of your reality. It may be subconscious, it may be conscious. You may bring it to the fore occasionally, but knowing that everything is black and white casts a pall, a shadow, upon your very being. And you know that it's just not right. Something is amiss. We don't really have the sunset and the beautiful painting. Not yet. So we go around the whole day in that fog, in that sense of loss. And nothing is quite right. And that's why even when we have a celebration, we break a glass. We admit that it's not quite right. And that's why we say, Meshkochech Yerushalayim. Because if you forget Yerushalayim, it means you think that today is good, that today is perfect. But no day can be perfect. And when we have that consciousness, we have that subconsciousness. And when we have that subconsciousness, we are entitled to say, Ki lishuascha kivinu, we hope for your salvation, and we hope all day long. We just keep hoping. There is, in that sense of the black and white, an interesting irony. And Tisha B'Av brings out that irony. When a person doesn't really want something and just pays lip service to it, he manages very nicely. So if we are really immersed in our golus, and we are so colorblind, and no one has whispered into our ear, then Tisha B'Av is more than enough. You cry once a year, and that's it. The idea of kol shelo nivne beis hamikdash b'yomav ki'ilu nechrav b'yomav, that if the Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt in his time, it's as if it was destroyed in his time, is only for the person who knows black and white and dreams and yearns for color. But there's an irony to that. Because when you dream for something and it means so much to you, there is a natural need for closure. There's a natural need to bring Mashiach now. We can't wait. The pain is so great. The struggle is so profound. And the struggle is on so many levels. We have no peace, not in Eretz Yisrael. We're surrounded literally like the sheep surrounded by 70 wolves. And they want to devour us. They convince the world that they're the nicest people on earth, and we are the culprits. But they want to devour us. And the world wants to devour us. And how long has it been since the world succeeded in devouring us? It's a very bitter golus. And how many people have lost their way? How many Jews have assimilated to oblivion? A person who wants that civilization, who wants that peace, the person who knows black and white is not color. He wants to push. He wants Mashiach to come to relieve us and to release us and to give us back the color of life and the civilization of Torah. And that could lead and has led to the most dangerous misunderstanding, to responding to miscues, and to lengthening the gullus and adding to the travails of the Churban. You yearn and you dream and you desire for Mashiach now, but you cannot pound the table and you cannot stomp your feet. And you cannot say Mashiach has arrived when he has not arrived. It doesn't work. And in the end, it brings tremendous disappointment and disaster and perhaps even destruction. You know, waiting is the hardest thing in the world. Maybe to lighten the mood a little bit, I'll tell you a cute story that actually happened to me. My Rebbetzin and I once went to a chasana. We go to many, many chasanas, Baruch Hashem, many weddings. And this particular wedding was in a hall called the Continental in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. What was unique about the hall at that time was that the wall of separation between men and women was so tight, was so complete, that there was no possibility of communicating wife with husband, husband with wife, and therefore, how did they know when to go home? He is in his part of the world, and she is in her part of the world, and never the twain shall meet. So what they do is, before they go in, they look at their clocks, they look at their watches, and they synchronize. And they say, at 10:30, we meet out here. When that works, it's wonderful. I came outside. My Rebbetzin came about 5 minutes later. But when I came outside, I saw this chassid. There is smoke coming out of his ears. He is livid. When she comes out, probably a half an hour after she's supposed to, and he's sitting there doing absolutely nothing, standing there, to be precise, on the sidewalk, and doing absolutely nothing, he's going to kill her. No, my name is Aharon HaKohen, Ohev Shalom V'Rodev Shalom. I say to myself, I have to do something to protect her, even though they are both total strangers to me. I go over to him and I say, you know, you're standing there, makes me inspired to answer a question. It provides for me an answer to a question I've had for many years, a question about a statement in the Gemara, in the Talmud. He looks at me as if I'm crazy. Who is this strange person? But he is a Jew, and a Jew has curiosity, and he's all ears. He wants to know what I'm talking about. Well, I've already won one round. He's almost forgotten about his wife. I tell him, you know, the Talmud says in the Gemara in Brachas, with what do women have the merit? Merit for Olam Haba, merit for Tchiyas HaMeisim, whatever. If they themselves are not studying the Holy Torah, the Talmud says, they wait for the husbands to come home, they wait for the children to come home, and that gives them the merit. So I had a question all along, you know, we put our feet into pails of cold water to be able to resist exhaustion, to stay awake so we can learn another Rashi, another Tosfos, another commentary on the Rambam. We learn day and night. We live a life of privation. We immerse ourselves heavily and with tremendous effort in the Holy Torah. And what do? To merit the same reward? They wait. So, what's that? What's waiting? How can they have the same reward? And he looks at me, and his eyes look kind of like brighten. And I say, you know what Hashem does from time to time? He makes the men wait. And then they realize that waiting is no simple business. And then they can understand why you can get such a big reward for waiting. The broadest of smiles, the brightest of smiles, went across his face. because he realized what I was saying to him. And just as if on cue, guess who walks out of the women's section? His wife, Sprinzer, or whatever her name was. And he says, come, Sprinzer, let's go home. Waiting is no small thing. Waiting requires more than patience. It requires emuna. And waiting requires an emuna which says, I am in God's hands, and I cannot tell Hashem what to do. And that is much harder than first seems, especially if you're a great rabbi, and especially even if you're not a charlatan. Even if you're not a charlatan, if you're a charlatan, take advantage of people's yearnings, hopes, dreams, aspirations. It's the most criminal thing in the world, because you want to be big, you want to be important. You know what happens to the charlatan also? He deludes himself. Eventually believes in everything that his prophet is saying about him. And from there he gains his power and his authority because he's so strong in his belief in himself. But let's say that you become that way because you can't handle the pain and suffering of the Jew, the individual Jew and the collective Klal Yisrael. Doesn't matter. You just have to wait. Im Yismahameya, says the Pasuk, the verse in Tanakh, if he is tarrying, if it takes time, God's good time, Chakelo, wait for him. Wait for him doesn't mean, because if he's not coming, don't forget about him. Wait for him means, don't jump the gun either. Waiting is a mode that is so delicate, because it says you can't forget, you cannot deny, you cannot fail to believe and have faith, but you cannot push the envelope. You cannot demand. You cannot say, Hashem, it's over. Either you bring Mashiach now or what? Because Hashem needs his golus for whatever reason. I want you to know something. There was always the sense from the rabbis in all the ages, in all the centuries, that there are two ways for Mashiach to come, either by being very good or by being very desperate. If we're very good, that's the only way we can force Hashem to bring Mashiach. Very good is a tremendous avoda. It doesn't come from making statements and screaming and yelling. It comes from a transformation of oneself, and it extends in a ripple effect to all of Klal Yisrael. That's what the rabbis meant, that if all of Israel would keep one Shabbos or two Shabbosim, keeping Shabbos is not simple. And for all of Israel to keep Shabbos and to keep two Shabbosim, not simple at all. Not simple at all. Or you just wait, and when it's desperate enough and Hashem sees it's time, he will bring Mashiach. To believe in that is much harder than being given a date or figuring out the time. But that knowledge and the waiting for it to happen go hand in hand, and it cannot be any other way. You know, it's very interesting, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, the great Rosh Yeshiva and mentor to thousands and thousands of rabbis and how many more Jews. He used to say, using a geometric term, a mathematical term, that the destiny of other nations is a straight line. And then he used to say that the destiny of the Jewish people is what he used to call a circular helix. Well, we're familiar with the word helix because we have in the chromosomes a double helix. You know what a helix is? A spring. The kind of spring that you find in click pens. If you put one vertically and you say this is the top and this is the bottom, and you want to climb up that spring, you're going in circles. It's not a straight line. And it might even appear at certain moments that you're actually going down, but in the end you realize that you're going up. But it's so convoluted And everybody knows that if you take that spring and you stretch it out, it's much, much longer, depending upon how many revolutions there are per inch. It's much, much longer than it first appears. The history of the Jewish people, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, is a circular helix history. We cannot fathom it many times. We don't understand the dips. But we are heading towards Yemos HaMashiach and the ultimate of history. You know, Maimonides asked the question, we suffer so much from the Christians and the Muslims. And he was talking about his time and how much more we've suffered since then. And from the echoes of Christianity, even in people who do not believe anymore, but are inspired by that kind of blood libel or anti-Semitism. It's such a bloody groundwork was laid. Why does Hashem want that? And he says something incredible. He says that even so, that we suffer so much, but the foundation is being laid throughout the world, in the darkest parts of Africa, in the backward jungles of Brazil. Foundations are being laid for a knowledge of one God by the Muslims, by the Christians, that are enwrapping and enveloping a world with the knowledge of God and the destruction of idolatry. And even though each one is so sorely mistaken, and each one has a distortion of the truth, but it is a distortion within the truth. And it lays the groundwork, he says, for everyone to accept the vision of Mashiach when Mashiach arrives. You know, it's very fascinating. 100 years ago, if somebody would have told you that Mashiach is going to come, and in a moment, all the Jews will go to Israel, and in a moment, the whole world will be inspired by such a vision, you would say it's impossible. How do you communicate with the whole world in a moment? And now we know that not only is it not impossible, but it happens every day. The whole world knows an event as it happens, whatever that event is. And you should know that in places where they don't have cars and they don't have highways for the cars, but everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has a cell phone. It's incredible. And there is this understanding, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, that the circular helix goes round and round and round and round. And we have Esav and we have Yishmael and we have the Muslims and we have the Christians and we have so much pain and so much suffering and so much despair, but yet we are marching to that moment of Ki Mitzion Teitzei Sora Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. We are marching towards that goal. And you'll ask me, what do we need all of this for? Well, you have the Rambam, but you have much more than that. You have the experience in Egypt. Someone asks a question, what did we do wrong before Egypt that we had to suffer Egypt? And you know what the answer is? Golus is not merely a punishment. Golus is a preparation. How it is exactly that Golus is a preparation, only God knows. Just like we could ask a lot of questions about our experience in Egypt, when the vast majority of Jews ended up being idol worshippers. Why is that a good thing? And why is that the crucible, the Kor HaBarzel? We do not know. But we do know that just as that was prologue to the glory of coming into Eretz Yisrael, so our Golus is prologue to the glory of Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. And with that I end, Rabbi Say. We have to wait and we have to have incredible patience. And waiting is not easy. But we have to know while we are waiting what we are waiting for. We're waiting for the black and white to be color. We're waiting to understand that a head is not just something you hang a hat on. And even though we cannot even fully appreciate what that means, precisely because our world is black and white, and precisely because we are so jaded by the gullus, and precisely because we are so blinded and stupefied by this gullus of ours, We cannot fully comprehend, but we trust the Navi. And it's Kili Shuascha Kivinu Kol Hayom. Every part of the day is black and white and not color. And we sense the emptiness. We sense the sadness. We sense the churban that is today's world. And we yearn consciously and unconsciously and subconsciously. We yearn for that moment. For that moment of Venoharu Elof Kol Agoyim. For the Goy to say it's Beis Elokei Yaakov, the house of the God of Jacob. And for them to stream for a civilization of Torah to inspire them. And that will be the Tikkun Olam that we yearn for in the second paragraph of Al Kein Nekaveh of the Aleinu L'Shabeach, which will yet have to happen because it cannot happen now. And then it will be Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Mirushalayim.